This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about DIY medicine. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. DIY medicine is tricky for a lot of healthcare providers because their patients could get harmed in their attempts to treat or cure themselves. But for one researcher and physician, investigating his patient's attempts to treat their devastating illness has become a source of valuable information. Grant Hill has more.
Curiosity has always been a driving force in Rick Bedlack's life. Noticing things, and then trying to figure out how they work or how they came to be.
One of my early memories is wrestling with my brother and rolling him down this hill in our backyard and seeing him get up and kind of stagger around and saying, what's going on? I'm feeling dizzy. So I roll myself down the hill and say, wow, that is interesting. You get that spinning sensation. And I'd run inside and I'd say, Mom, you know, why does this happen? And, you know, we're talking like in the 70s here. There was no, you couldn't just pick up your phone and figure this out. So my mom would say, you know, write it down, I'll drop you at the library.
As Rick got older, his questions, the answers, and the books he'd find them in all got much longer and much more complicated. But over time, he began to see how they all had to do with the same thing, the brain.
I'd say, Mom, why does that person shuffle when they walk? Why does their hand shake when they write? Why are their eyes misaligned? Write it down. And so I had a great librarian who would try to help me figure out some of this stuff, and I just kept gravitating toward classes and programs and schools that would help me understand this connection between the brain and how we behave, how we look, how we act.
When Rick grew up and went to medical school, he knew neurology was the field for him. But it wasn't until his residency that he saw a patient with an illness that he wanted to dedicate his entire career to, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis.
I came across my first person with ALS. And it was the most dramatic example of this connection between a nervous system that's on fire and what somebody looks like in clinic. But here's a person with ALS and they have muscles that are shriveled up and they're twitching and they're weak and their reflexes are like off the chart increased. So it was like, holy cow, I've never heard a story like this. I've never seen an exam like this. And then my attending came into the room and said, this is what it's called. We don't know why it happens and there's nothing we can do about it. Just go home and get your affairs in order. And I drove home that day and I said, I think this is going to be the disease for me because it's fascinating.
Of course, Rick knew that ALS wasn't just some mystery to crack. It was a death sentence for tens of thousands of Americans. Given the severity, this seemed like a way to put his natural curiosity to good use, to find what causes this unrelenting disease and maybe find ways to reverse it.
There's not really a lot of options or a lot of hope for people. And so what an opportunity for someone like me to build a program that gives people those things.
Rick went to work at Duke University School of Medicine, becoming the university's first endowed professor of ALS. And because many of the answers he was looking for about the disease couldn't be found in books, he began to consult more intensely with his patients, treating them more like colleagues than cases.
I try to learn things about my patients. You know, what about your life can I learn? Can I come to an event that you're doing? I mean, I've been to archery events and golf tournaments and poker tournaments and all kinds of crazy things that I got to meet these people outside of work.
Rick quickly discovered that many of his new partners weren't waiting around for doctors and researchers to save them. And that was a bit of a surprise to him.
Nobody ever taught me in neurology how common it was for people to walk away from clinic and to reach out to this, what I call this space of alternative and off-label treatments. But it was clear in the first few years of me leading this program that most of my patients were coming in with bags full of stuff.
Vitamins, unapproved serums, acupuncture programs. There were dozens of supposedly effective elixirs and therapies touted on sketchy websites or anonymous forums, the kind of quote-unquote treatments that were easy for physicians to dismiss or ignore.
Really, they weren't even being recorded, much less talked about. Like, they weren't getting into any medical record. So one day I asked, what is all this stuff? And somebody said, well, I figured you probably wouldn't want to talk about this. And then, the more I thought about it, I said, wow. I mean, if this is a common thing that people are doing this, shouldn't I be interested?
Getting new clinical trials off the ground can take years, time many of his patients simply didn't have. If they were looking elsewhere for answers, didn't Rick have a responsibility to weigh in on what they were trying?
I mean, shouldn't I want to partner with patients using, you know, my years of training and experience in medicine and science to try to maybe help them make more informed decisions about these?
Many of his colleagues in medicine disagreed.
I'd say the majority of my peers said this is a terrible idea because all you're going to do is lend some legitimacy to some of these strange products and websites that are out there. They're going to say, you know, this product is under investigation by Dr. Bedlack at Duke and this team of respected scientists. And they're right.
But Rick thought overall, the good outweighed the bad. In 2009, Rick put together a group of like-minded researchers and created ALS Untangled, which is dedicated to investigating alleged or emerging ALS treatments online.
So I just came up with this idea. Hey, what if we work together? You know, what if we crowdsource this, like built a team of clinicians and scientists who were interested in doing this together?
They dug in on the group's first product review, iPlex, which contained a man-made insulin-like growth factor whose dysregulation has long been thought to be involved in ALS. The review concluded that data from a seemingly promising Italian study lacked a control group and was potentially tainted with selection bias.
You know, to really investigate one thing, it takes a while. And, you know, nobody has time if there's hundreds of these things out there, which there are. Nobody has time to do them all.
The researcher said iPlex was probably a bust and could be risky to take. Since then, the ALS Untangled team has grown to over 130 researchers across 11 countries.
Since 2009, there hasn't been a single day that I haven't at some point been working on a review of a product that a patient asked about.
The group has reviewed dozens of products and therapies, keeping the information up to date whenever new evidence becomes available. Most treatments have been relatively unremarkable, some pretty dangerous, but a minority have actually shown real promise.
There's 8 products. There's a product called acetyl-L-carnitine. There's a group of products called antiretrovirals.
The work gave Rick and his team permission to wander down strange paths just to see where they could lead. And now, one of the strangest of them all may finally be paying off. 2 years after publishing that first ALS Untangled review, Rick stumbled across yet another seemingly unreliable internet rumor related to ALS.
Mrs. Nelda Buss of Blacksburg, Virginia, used to be a fiscal analyst at Virginia Tech. She is now a victim of ALS.
I came across a video of a woman from Virginia who said, you know, that she had ALS, that it was rapidly progressing, that she had lost almost all of her function.
I was completely paralyzed from the neck down, and I couldn't move anything. Mm-hmm.
Her name was Nelda Buss, a mother of two whose ALS journey began in the mid-80s when she told her primary care doctor about some foreboding, mysterious symptoms she was experiencing.
It started with my weak hands. I went to him in November, and then my legs sort of were getting weak. I fell a couple times.
Nelda was officially diagnosed when she was 47.
My husband picked me up, and I think we cried all the way home.
Nelda went to see ALS experts, experts Rick knew were the best in the business back then, but she just kept getting worse.
I was diagnosed in January, and by July, I was in a wheelchair.
Desperate, Nelda sought help from an energy healer in New York City named Dean Kraft. She had heard about him from a magazine article. She told her story on the daytime talk show The View back in 1998.
The first time I went to him, he gave me the first treatment, and my diaphragm was beginning to weaken, and I couldn't breathe as well as I could before, and I noticed I could cough and blow my nose better.
Every other week for over a year, Nelda and her husband would drive up from their home in Virginia. She was carried into a small office where Dean Kraft would place his hands over her head and release healing energy, he said.
He would work like 2 hours on Saturday on me and 2 hours on Sunday.
In total, these sessions cost Nelda about $25,000.
He said, you know, you just can't always
believe the doctors.
Dean Kraft died in 2013 of a massive heart attack. He was 63. He was also featured in the same segment from The View and other videos about Nelda's story.
I don't require people to believe in religion. They don't even have to believe in me. I just lay my hands on them, and fortunately, the majority of people get well.
And that's what happened with Nelda.
I had a walking party at the Marriott Hotel, so I had Dean come to the party.
Rick was shocked when he first came across Nelda's story.
She said she went to see an energy healer, and over the next 2 years, she completely recovered. And in fact, the video was pretty convincing.
Again, Rick's curiosity kicked in. He contacted Nelda and asked if she would give permission for her doctors to send Rick her medical records.
And they did send everything to him.
By the time I finished those, I was absolutely convinced that she really did have ALS, that she progressed to where she was nearly dead. And then she made a full recovery over the next 2 years under the care of this energy healer. What I wasn't convinced of is that it was the energy healing that made her better, in part because it had no plausible mechanism. Like, there is no known biological mechanism where a person can have energy come out of their hands that heals dying motor neurons. And so I did reach out to the energy healer and said, I don't know how it is that this happened, but I'd like to do a small study of your technique in about 10 more patients. And I'll never forget his response. He said, Richard, for those who believe, no more proof is necessary. And for those who don't, no proof is ever going to be enough. And that's the last I ever heard of him.
But the story started a conversation within his small team of researchers about other inexplicable disease reversals.
They said, did you know these kinds of cases have actually been reported in the literature since the 1960s? And in fact, many of the people on the ALS Untangled team had said, well, you know, I saw somebody that I thought had ALS and they progressed for a while and then they recovered.
His colleagues told Rick they just thought those patients had been misdiagnosed, that they really didn't have ALS. But for Rick, this was a light bulb moment.
And I was like, wait a second. How are we not studying these people? How many of them are there? I mean, there's a precedent for studying people who are unexpectedly resistant to diseases and finding, you know, pathways that have never been manipulated and finding treatments to manipulate those pathways that wind up helping everyone.
So Rick started yet another program to study these reversal cases, digging out medical records, sending out questionnaires, trying to find commonalities. So far, Rick has confirmed 22 other ALS reversals. And just last year, it spawned a breakthrough.
We actually found a target. About a third of these patients appear to have a genetic abnormality that's very, very rare in people with typically progressive ALS. And we are now doing a much larger study to see in a huge population of people with ALS, is there a relationship? But again, here I am like in a space and a direction that I never thought I would be.
Nelda Buss is now 82 years old, and she still believes Dean Kraft saved her life.
Oh yeah, I do.
But Nelda is open to other explanations, assuming Rick Bedlack and his tireless team of researchers can find one.
That story was reported by Grant Hill.